Mr. Shippy Reel 3, you were saying that many of the gliders weren't fit afterwards.
Well, to my knowledge, there's only about one glider that I think was fit for takeoff from Broadway. We stayed at Broadway that night. And was helping on the strip because the following night they began to land Dakotas, which brought in the rest of the brigade and the rest of the equipment.
What were conditions on the landing strip that night?
Well, surprisingly, very quiet. There's no Japs within miles, I don't think, at the time.
But was it a picture of chaos?
It was organised chaos. It was, as we came in, we were hauled off to our area where our column was. It was a well organised landing from our part, from the organisers' part. Because I think that someone had gone in on the 5th to sort of start to prepare the situation and organise these sort of things.
Were you injured on landing?
No. There was some gliders crashed and there was some casualties. But they happened to, I think, men of in the King's Liverpool, which was another one of our... another one of our brigade. They took some casualties in the landing, but I don't know exactly how many. Not offhand.
So after landing, you were hauled away where to?
Well, we went to our bivouac area. And that night, two of our, me and my mucker, we was put out on what they call listening post.
Who was your mucker?
Well, my actual mucker, unfortunately, just before we flew in, he was taken very ill, because I didn't know what was the matter with him at the time. We woke up this morning, he's all bumps all over his body, and he said he felt real bad and he looked bad. So I said, well, you better go sick. He said, I ain't going sick now. Typical, I ain't going sick, dodging the column. He said, no way. I said, well, you can't go, I said, you're ill, man. He said, you can't go on now. So I called the corporal and I told him to put him on sick. And he went on sick, and of course he was hauled off to hospital. He got malaria. That's the first we've seen of actual malaria. So I come by another lad. I don't know what happened to his mucker or how it come about, but anyway, I had put with this other lad, and he was my mucker from then on. And the idea of this listening post was that we went out 200 or 300 yards into the jungle, which was a dense jungle, and there we were. 200 miles beyond the Jap lines, the jungle full of Japs, in our imagination, as far as we knew. And we were sat there listening, and it was a night as black as pitch, because no stars, no nothing coming through the jungle. It was really dark. It was a very worrying couple of hours that we sat there whispering to each other. But nothing happened. We could hear all sorts of jungle noises, the hyenas and the crickets and things like that, and these crickets had a very bad habit. The jungle would be a wild noise, of crickets and noise, and then suddenly it all stopped. I mean, there must be millions of these things in the jungle, and yet suddenly everyone would stop as one, and there'd be dead silence, not a sound. And then it would all start up again. It was weird. And as I say, we got through our 2 hours, and The following day is the day that we, I think it was the following day, we as a column marched out of Broadway.
Did you know what your objective was?
Yes. Our objective, or the brigade's objective actually, was to go into the Morgong Valley and to cut the Japanese lines of communication, I think between, cut the railway, which was a railway and road, on the, between Morgong and Michinawa, in the railway corridor. The idea being to allow, to stop the supplies getting up to the, where the Chinese, under General Stilwell, American-trained Chinese, were pushing down with the object of reopening the Burma Road, to get supplies through to China. And our job was to go and cut these lines of communication. This was the 77th Brigade job.
So you said your column marched off?
We marched off. We was ordered not to use tracks, so it was cutting through dense jungle. Caldervet and the rest of the column, they'd also moved off, and they'd made direct for the this area to establish this block. We was to get into the area and to lay ambush to protect those who were establishing the block. We was what they called at that time a floating column. We laid several ambushes, but they were fruitless. Some of the left parts of the column at different places. I think some of them had a little bit of success with Japs coming through. But our first encounter was with a Jap. The most terrifying time of my life was there was firing in the front of the column, and we all took cover. And then the word came down, commando platoon forward. So we moved forward to the head of the column. And it seems that we were going to counterattack with our column, with our platoon. Well, there's some firing going on. And our officer, Captain Butler, and the column commander had gone forward, I assume probably on a recce. We could also hear engines, lorry engines. I thought, well, you know, what's going on here? And of course, when they said they were going to counterattack with us, well, I thought, you know, this is it. This is the first time. And I think I'm on the verge of panic as much as anything as the news act. I know this, I was never as frightened as that again, ever. Well, that first time. However, it didn't materialise. They decided that they'd pull back a little bit and they'd call in our aircraft, air cover, because we had our own air support, which was a number one American Air Commando. And it happened that there were some of the their planes in the vicinity, and they came in, and it turned out it was a Japanese debussing point for the Japanese that had found, you know, were coming to stop these. The brigade had already got to this area and had attacked this area, which there was a few Japs, so quite a number of Japs at Marlow, where I was going to establish this block. These were reinforcements who were on the way there to them. And it took quite the Air Force, we pulled back, and the Air Force did quite a good job of several sorties and bombed the living daylights out of them. That was the first time that actually we took our first casualty. I think probably Bill will have told you about that, where the lad got wounded in his foot.
Can you describe it?
Well, there's nothing to describe, really. As I say, there was some firing when we was in position there, and then we got up to move away. And this lad in the platoon, he started to limp. And, you know, what's the matter? I've got a blister on my foot or something, my foot out. And this, he got worse and worse as we went on. And we took his rifle and we took his pack and we were carrying them between us till we got to the next halt. And of course we said, no, come on, let's get your boot off and get the, you know, get a plaster on that. And so you get your own, you know, carry your own equipment. Anyway, when we took his boot off, it was full of blood. And it turned out, in fact, a bullet had gone through the top of his pack, through his pack, out the bottom of it, and down through his foot. And that is when our first experience of the jungle of building an airstrip, we had to go out and find a clearing, which was big enough to take one of these light aircraft, the LI-5s, flatten it, and go to the radio for one of these light planes, which flew in, took him out to back to Broadway, and then to fire from there onto India to hospital. But that was our actual first casualty. We later on, after that, was patrolling in around the block, and Brigadier Calvert at that time had established the block. And we hadn't seen any Japs or heard of, you know, anything at all in our area where we were. So eventually we was called into the block, our column, and we had to take up positions actually in the block. Our other column carried on patrolling outside the block, but 20 column Mike brought into the block, and we was put on a perimeter. By then, there was bunkers built around the hills, each one interlinked with a slit trench. They started barbed wire themselves in. The barbed wire was being dropped by aircraft every night or every day and put in position around us, in front of us, and the RE's booby-trapped areas and around us. And there was still no trouble from the Japs. And it was at this time that we were in and we sort of got established in the block that Wingate came round to inspect the positions with Brigadier Calvert. And he went round all our positions and just said everything was, he thought everything was okay, and he wished us luck. And he left our hill, and that's the last time we ever saw Wingate. He got killed on flying out.
What was your opinion of Wingate?
My opinion? Well, I think Wingate was a marvellous man. I don't think it needed a man of his ideas to produce the men for that sort of warfare. That we're not jungle people, are we? He taught us to live and survive in the jungle. I mean, it was a case really of not only fighting in the jungle, but you had to come to terms with the jungle. You had to live with the jungle. The jungle, you had to realise it not only was an enemy, it was a friend. He pushed us on these marches and things like that, with his idea was that when you think you've had enough, you only think you've had enough. If need be, you can get up and do another half mile, another 2 miles. Which later on we found we had to. You know, that when you thought you'd come to the end of your tether, you really haven't. This is the sort of thing that it needed, that sort of man, and I think this is what really got through to us all in the finish, that if you was to survive, you really had to go to the limit. Because to set off with that pack on your back, in I mean, you can imagine a day like this.
A hot day.
I mean, you think it's hot here. You'll be well over the hundreds when we were training out there. In the sun, in day, you know, broad day right across lunchtime when the sun's right at its height. You're plodding along with a 60, 70 pound pack on your back. You just set off in the morning with this great thing on your back and your body would suddenly start to burn up. And you was in agonies. You were absolutely, absolutely on fire. Until you started to perspire. And then, you know, it was like pouring water in a radiator of a car. The car go, it would be running out of your arms, off your fingertips. Your whole body would be absolutely wet through. Every stitch of clothing was wet through. But up to then, it was really agony. And you used to stop every 10 minutes in every hour. And then get up and walk on again. I mean, you had to have the willpower to go on day after day after day after day with doing this. And it was, I think it was all a lot of willpower with them.
So you,
you just didn't complain. No more the grumbling than we normally do, you know. Oh, God, are we, you know, here we go again, you know. When they used to shout, packs on, you know, oh, here we go again, oh, sure up, you know. This sort of thing, but... all good humoured.
So I interrupted you with you on this perimeter on the block, and you said that was the last you saw a Wingate. If you can pick it up from there?
Yeah, well, then it became a sort of routine. You got up in the morning, you had it each evening because you stood till after dark. And then you sort of we had your guards out and what have you. One of you is nearly always awake. Nothing much happened. We went out on a couple of patrols from there. Didn't see anything. And which, you know, it got to be, you know, what is anything ever going to happen? It happened. We got to sort of routine whereby that you come to tea time and we'd brew up, say 4 o'clock time, and sit around on top of the bunker or on that side of the hill or where have you, in little groups, having a little chat just before, have your tea and stand to. And this night, bang, from nowhere. Well, everything went up that night. He started to... Artillery opened up. And he really went to town on us. I think he took the whole block completely by surprise. Did this first, the first one, not expecting it. And we got really shelled, and because... We went into position, and I think that was the first night, that particular night, that first night, that Malmucker and I, we were in a slip trench, which was at the back, we'll say at the back of this hill. The main bunkers and positions were around the front of the hill. And we were at the back of the hill, and our view from there was straight across from us was another hill which was occupied by us. Between us was the so-called road, the railway being further over the other side, not in our area. The road actually being just more or less a mud track. And then, over sort of slightly to our left, was a big open paddy field, surrounded by jungle, and some maybe a mile away was the outskirts of the village Morlu, and you could see the huts and the Golden Pagoda from this position. And of course we dived for this cover, and this shelling carried on. All we saw really that night was the bursting of, we assume, were Japan grenades, the little puffs of black smoke above our heads, and every now and again a load of muck would come sliding down the hill, which fortunately I was at a slight overhang and it sort of missed us and went down the hill. And there was a lot of firing and shouting and crying going on, and every now and again flares went up, and we still saw nothing from our position at all. However, the following morning, the Japs had attacked the other side of the hill, and we'd lost about three or four men. And we was moved from there into one of the bunkers at the front, which really, in a way, I wasn't sorry for, because we felt a bit out on the limb round the back, because, you know, no connection, no touch really with anybody. Not that you would have seen anybody anywhere, because anything that moved at night was shot. So once you was in your slip trench at stand to, you didn't move out of that slip trench till the following morning. Because anything that moved after dark was immediately shot. That was the order. And this started a continuation, but we got sort of used to this idea that about 4 o'clock we used to brew our tea, and then we'd go into the bunkers, and then sure enough, a few minutes after that, the Jap would start shelling us. He had what we called the whiz bang, which we assume was artillery, but also a thing we call a coal scuttle, which is a horrifying flipping thing. This thing used to come over and it used to swish. You'd go shoo, 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 and then bang. But you could hear this one coming, the whiz bang, you couldn't. By the time you heard the whiz, which, you know, you was only halfway down when the bang come. But this thing, you heard this thing coming, and you had a few seconds to get down before this big thing come. And this turned out to be a 6-inch mortar, which had a shell that was about 5 foot long and about 6 inches round, that the Japs were using against us. You'd see a tree where 1 minute this thing would explode and the tree would just fall down. It cut the tree, snap the tree straight off, the shrapnel from it. Of course, we used to get into the bunkers, and this shelling would then, they used to sort of start in front of us, on this in front, and then they used to start to move back over us when it was our turn, and then it would move further back, in which turn then the cries used to come in and the Jap used to come in. And you spend the the shelling was on, and up to stand to, you was in the bunker, which was a hole dug in the ground with a good solid roof with timber or what have you, and muck on top, which was like a little air raid shelter with just a porthole at the front. But at stand to, we had to come out of the bunkers and was in the slip trenches. The bunkers were only used the whole time was for the actual shelling. We was actually in these slip trenches, which one could just about kneel in, and two to a slip trench, and there was a series of a bunker, a slip trench, a bunker, a slip trench, all the way around our particular hill. This, I'm only talking about our particular hill. the area covered something like, I think, about 1,000 square yards of different hills that saddled the road and the railway. And various parts of the brigade were on the various hills. The Jap continued these attacks. As I say, we came out into the bunkers, out of the bunkers into the slip trenches. And we stayed in them all the night. The flares, mortar flares, would go over and you'd see all these figures coming screaming up towards you. And of course you fired your rifle, you threw grenades. My mucker had a cup discharger, which was a rifle bound with copper wire to reinforce it, with a little cup on the top, which had dropped a 7-second grenade in. Fired a blank cartridge, and this propelled this thing something like 100 yards or 200 yards or whatever you like to send it. And I was alongside him with a rifle and grenades. And of course, this would go on for first, and that was the only attack, I think, on the first night. But then the attacks got so that they would come in at dusk, at stand to, and then there was peter out, and then early midnight, and then probably again just before dawn. They would come in again, and the same thing would continue, you know, complete just complete noise that you absolutely deafen you.
Did you ever see any of the attacking Japanese?
We could only see figures. When the flares went over, you could see all these figures and, you know, coming up. Fortunately, they didn't get through our wire. They blew the wire with the Bangalore torpedoes. But to me, they did this. They brought onto them the Bren guns and what have you, and everybody, I think we just more or less closed the gap with Jap bodies until they tried somewhere else. Only we just saw was these masses and masses of figures coming up. And of course, the next morning, there'd be these bodies lying about. We used to spend the next morning doing any bunker, you know, anywhere the damage where you were, and re-putting the wire up and what have you. And then you'd just get into a normal routine. You know, you go down to the river, which was just outside the block, for your water, and have a quick wash and back again. And then the same thing would apply again. Before you got what bit of sleep you could during the day, if you can call it sleep, you could, you know, it's a blazing hot sun outside, because it's virtually taken every